Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You can talk polls and rallies and debates as long as you want, but eventually voters have to vote. So on the broadcast today, what Floridians are going to be voting about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 30th of January, 2012. It's a Monday, which means tomorrow is Tuesday. And so in accordance with this year's primary calendar, Florida Republicans are going to be on the hot seat tomorrow. Voters will be thinking about a lot of things as they go to vote. Immigration, probably. Space policy, maybe. Jobs and the economy, absolutely. The unemployment rate in Florida is just shy of 10%. The state has added jobs this past year. They're just not the right kinds of jobs. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone reports.
It's 11 in the morning at Florida International University.
Are there any questions from last week or anything at all?
About 40 students stagger into class like an invasion of zombies.
Nobody's awake today.
A PowerPoint starts up.
Reasons for failure.
The sleepy students, the boring PowerPoint. That's where the typical college experience ends. The professor, Samantha DeBianchi, is 27 years old. She's dressed a little like AC/DC's guitar player. Short shorts, a white button-up shirt, black tie, black cardigan. DeBianchi is a former nightclub manager, and this is her nightclub management class.
I would tell my doorman, nobody's in the club, hold the door. Say it's a private party, say we have some celebrity in here. Make it look busy at the door. Everyone wants what they can't have.
Like jobs in Florida. Right now, there are more than 900,000 Floridians looking for a job. The housing bust is still reverberating. Florida continues to lose construction jobs, and thanks to plummeting property values, continues to lose government jobs as well. It's worth noting, then, that the strangest thing about this nightclub class is the job prospect for these kids.
We're hitting that 90-plus percent placement rate.
Randall Upchurch is associate dean of FIU's School of Hospitality. Nightclub management is just one tiny part of what the program offers. Upchurch says even during the worst of the downturn, FIU hospitality grads were getting placed.
The good thing is tourism is a major driver in the state. You know that full well. That's kind of why you're here.
Tourism has added more than 30,000 positions over the last year. In South Florida, about one of every four new jobs is in hospitality.
In other words, we're leading with areas where we have a competitive advantage.
Tony Villamil is a former U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce and the Dean of the Business School at St. Thomas University. Last year, Florida added about 113,000 jobs. Not great, says Villamil.
Usually when you come out of a recession, you see Florida growing at 200,000 to 250,000 a year in jobs.
It doesn't help that Florida's top two growth sectors, hospitality and retail, are full of low-wage jobs. The average hospitality worker barely earns $20,000 a year. Villamil says knowledge-based, technology jobs fuel a true recovery.
We need higher incomes and therefore higher spending and therefore higher economic activity.
Wow, this is a crazy office.
Yeah, this is cool.
About 15 miles outside Fort Lauderdale, some of those higher-paying jobs are taking root at Saveology's new corporate headquarters. The web-based marketing company promises to create 700 jobs over the next 3 years. Their new offices look like Tom Hanks' apartment in the movie Big. There's a colonnade of free candy machines, a full-size putting green, a full-size basketball court, and...
One of the macaws speaking to us. Very Google-ish type of atmosphere.
Michael Wallace is the CFO of Saveology. Given the shortage of tech jobs, you wouldn't think Saveology would need free gumballs and caged parrots to fill openings.
We want the best of the best, not just what kind of economies of scale can we get because of a deteriorating economic marketplace.
Saveology is looking 3, 5, 10 years ahead, says Wallace. By most estimates, it'll take about that long for the job market to fully recover and for more Google-ish places to be hiring in Florida again. In the meantime, there's always nightclub management class. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Not Florida, but Europe. That was the story of the day elsewhere in capitalism. I know. What else is new? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Please stop me if you've heard this one before, but there was a big meeting in Brussels, Belgium today about the European debt crisis. It came as Greek and German officials started getting testy, shall we say, with each other about how much Athens owes to whom and who is going to be in charge of fixing it. We've got Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the line from London for an update. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So we'll get to the nuts and the bolts of this meeting that's happening today in just a bit. But first, what is the latest with the Greeks and this, okay, I'll say it, never-ending saga of their debt crisis?
Well, doesn't this tell you everything you need to know? We're still talking about Greece, which started the whole crisis 2 years ago. The Greeks are seeking a second bailout. If they don't get it by the middle of February, they could default. There's a lot of problems with this. The Greeks say they cannot possibly fulfill the conditions which the rest of their Eurozone partners have laid down. They can't privatize all these assets. They can't sell off Greek islands. They can't sell anything because nobody wants to buy them in this climate. So we're in a very fraught situation with the Germans getting exasperated and saying the Greeks can't control their own budget. We should send somebody in to do the job for them.
Well, that's an important point, actually. I mean, the Germans want control over Greek taxes and economy and budgets. They want it to be outsourced, if you will. I mean, literally a European official in charge of it.
That's right. And, well, this has ruffled a few feathers in Athens. They see this as an issue of national sovereignty. The idea of having foreigners, let alone Germans, in Brussels dictating budget policy to the Greeks, it's causing a lot of anxiety and angst in Athens.
All right. To the meeting then today in Brussels, Stephen. This is, by my count, the 16th European
That's
debt
right.
crisis summit we've had. What can they possibly still be talking about?
Well, oddly enough, debt and deficit reduction is not top of the agenda. It's growth and jobs. Since this crisis began, the Germans in particular have focused almost exclusively on debt, on cutting deficits, on cutting public spending. But today, economic growth and job creation has magically appeared at the top of the agenda.
How does that happen, though, when the word of the day over there is austerity? How do you grow when you're cutting?
Well, indeed. I mean, how do you square that circle? Cynics say that actually there hasn't been any change of emphasis, that job creation and economic growth is not really top of the agenda, but they have to talk about it because unemployment in particular is more serious in the Eurozone than it is in the US. It's more than 10% and rising across the Eurozone as a whole. And youth unemployment in some countries is absolutely horrendous. I mean, around 50% of Greek and Spanish kids, that's 18 to 24-year-olds, are unemployed. So this summit has to focus on growth and jobs. But the expectations, I should say, are not particularly high that they're going to come up with any viable solutions.
And there will be more meetings then on Greece and what the Germans want and all that. So this is, it's not over by a long shot, as we say.
Last year when we were talking, Kai, I predicted this whole thing would either blow up or resolve itself by the middle of October. You poo-pooed the suggestion, as I recall. You were right, so I think I better stay out of the prediction business.
And yet we keep having you on the radio. Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
The internet savvy among you who stored your files on the file sharing site Mega Upload may want to pay special heed to this next story. The Justice Department, as you remember, shut down Mega Upload earlier this month, alleging copyright violations. That means the companies Mega Upload had hired to store all that data aren't being paid anymore. So maybe as soon as Thursday, officials say they could end up pulling the plug. A lawyer for Mega Upload says at least 50 million customers are in danger of having their data erased completely, and that in turn is raising questions about the fast-growing industry known as cloud computing. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
It's not hard to imagine a young Mega Upload user somewhere telling his teacher, "The cloud ate my homework," given the growing popularity of so-called cloud storage. Tech author and consultant David Ammerland says collaborating musicians used the site to swap large music files back and forth, while others simply stored their files for easy remote access.
This could be things which are private in terms of your business. It could be perhaps family photographs. It could be videos you have taken which have personal value for you. On a personal level, it's absolutely devastating.
Amerlan says both Apple and Google have conditioned smartphone users to store pictures on their clouds. Businesses are shifting their record-keeping to the cloud. Computer security advocate Lauren Weinstein says that's with good reason. It's safer to store your data remotely, away from fire or theft, for example. He says the irony is it's not safe if the government blocks your access.
Remote backup on remote servers makes the most sense from the standpoint of security and reliability, but you do have to have the legal structure there to protect that data.
At Houston-based file-sharing and storage site MediaFire, CEO Derek Labian says the Mega Upload case demonstrates the need to choose your cloud carefully. He points out Mega Upload wasn't based in the U.S.
I think people should be weary about using any service where they don't have much transparency. You don't know who's operating the services. You don't know where the data is being stored. I mean, that's just a good rule of thumb, common sense.
Labian says he doubts this case will slow the move to cloud computing, which he says is growing at a breakneck pace. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We've all gotten that email, supposedly from Bank of America, right? But with half the words misspelled. Producer here at Marketplace got one from Facebook, spelled F-A-S-E. The word for that, of course, is spelled S-P-A-M. It's spam. Today, some of the biggest names in email, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and some online banking biggies like Bank of America and PayPal are launching a project to try to restore our trust in their email. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The scams are getting more sophisticated, or so says Craig Spiesel at the nonprofit Online Trust Alliance.
Millions of mails have been sent out purporting to come from the Better Business Bureau, targeting businesses and consumers.
So I've actually received this Better Business Bureau email. I don't have a business.
Right. So they don't care about you. They're trying multiple approaches.
Today, several companies are launching a group that will try to keep those scammy emails out of your inbox. The effort goes by the catchy name Domain-Based Message Authentication Reporting and Conformance, or DMARC. Brett McDowell is chair of DMARC.org and also is in charge of security at PayPal.
The payoff of what DMARC introduced is huge.
McDowell says it allows companies to verify their email and get anything that isn't verified deleted. By some estimates, phishing cost U.S. companies about $15 billion in the last 5 years, not to mention lost trust.
No one wants their customers wondering whether or not they should read a notification.
I mean, this is not a silver bullet, and there isn't a silver bullet for phishing.
Steve Myers teaches computer science at Indiana University Bloomington.
Phishing is a form of, you know, con fraud, and we've been dealing with con men for thousands of years, and we're not going to get away from them tomorrow on the internet because we implement this.
So Myers says before you click, make sure an email has been spell checked. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We've been airing a commentary series the past couple of weeks. It's called My Life is True. They're stories of people from the hard edge of the economy. Today, Leo Webb and his discovery that the skills he learned while serving in Iraq don't translate to civilian life. A note, there is some graphic language.
I went to Rite Aid to buy some instant coffee. Outside, I heard shots and saw a man run by. He moved so quick, he stepped out of his shoe. 4 shots rang out. He went down. Then the killer shot him twice more. I'm on the ground covering my head. I just got back from Iraq. I'm thinking, now I'm home and I'm going to get hit by a ricocheted bullet? I was the closest person to the killer. If I had a weapon, I would have killed him myself. I was a sniper in the Middle East. I didn't want to do that. But the Army finds your talent, and that's what I did. I got 17 confirmed kills. I didn't see their faces. I only saw them through a scope and blew their brains out. I didn't meet them or ask how many kids they had. When you kill somebody, you kill their family too. It all goes downhill. When the Army let me out, they said, "Are you going to be okay?" "No, I'm not," I said. "I killed all these people and watched half my squadron die. I'm a mess. I struggle every day. The Army taught me to drink. That's what I lean on now. I had hoped to be a professional athlete. I pitched for the Chicago Cubs in Double A. I got hurt. I got old. There went my dream right there. Now I'm a professional in a field I can't get a job in. I have to get it together because I have a daughter I love so much. I talked to her on the phone. "Daddy, I love you," she said. "You're a hero."
Leo's story comes to us from My Life is True. That's a project of the New America Foundation in collaboration with KQED in San Francisco. You can send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up.
Just go on to Google and type, "Why are Indians..."
Okay. Oh, that's horrible. Well, it's more interesting than horrible, really, but still. First, though, let's do the numbers. Concerns that Portugal could become the next domino in the European debt crisis helped push stocks lower today. The Dow Industrials clawed back from a big early drop, lost just 6 points at the bell, less than a 10%, closed at 12,653. NASDAQ ditched 4 points, that's a 10%, 2811. The S&P 500 slid 3 points, a 0.25%, 1313. Is the number you're looking for. Helping drive the Dow lower, Bank of America shares crumpled 3%. Other financials followed suit. Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs each shrank about 2% today. Tech stocks were mixed. Shares of chipmaker Broadcom fizzled 1.75%. Texas Instruments and Applied Materials both dropped about 1.33%. On the positive side, shares of Dell booted up 1.4%. Apple and Microsoft each rose 1.3%. IBM banked an increase of 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. What's going on in your head when you think about the economy? The Conference Board issues its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee discusses the U.S. and global energy outlook for 2012. And English musician John Lydon turns 56. He's known to fans as Johnny Rotten. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's some reassuring news on the macroeconomic personal finance front today. We learned this morning that personal income rose in December by the biggest amount in 9 months. And here comes the good part, Americans saved almost all the extra money they brought home. That's no mean thing in a country where debt is all too familiar. Debt is, in fact, and has long been, an American way of life. Lewis Hyman has a new book out. It's called Borrow: The American Way of Debt. Lewis, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So, you know, people have been borrowing and lending since basically there were people, right? I mean, it's been thousands and thousands of years. What, though, is different about the way we do it, the way Americans do it?
Yes, it's one of those rare things in history where it's actually has been done since the dawn of time, as so many undergrad essays say. What's different about debt in the 20th century is that it's profitable. So if you look at debt in the 19th century, it was either unprofitable or it was illegal. So you have instances like the Singer Sewing Machine Company, which, you know, would sell things on the installment plan. But those plans always lost money for the company. They made up those losses by selling sewing machines. And then the other end, you have loan sharks. And loan sharks charge exorbitant rates, but they, of course, were illegal. In the 20th century, you see the emergence of profitable legal lending. And that's what the story of Borrow is all about, how that changed our culture and changed the way we live.
Does it become profitable because it becomes impersonal? I mean, nobody knows their banker anymore, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think part of the story is how do you go from a personal relation of debt, you know, whether it's from your older brother or your bartender, to being something that is done through institutions. And that debt, in turn, is resold. It becomes something that is not a personal connection the way it had been.
Yeah, which gets us to, writ very large, the banking industry, right? And depending on who you talk to, banks are either directly responsible for the free flow of capitalism and thus the economic glory that is America, or it is a vampire squid on the face of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, either way, it's a monster and it's impersonal and it's treated as if it were, you know, something that we can't control. And I think what is important to realize is banks, for the most part, follow the rules, rules that we give them and rules that we can control. And in the book, I show that bankers want to do good. They want to help society for the most part. They also want to make a profit, obviously. But we can shape the way in which that profit has been made.
So I'm going to come at this next question with the avowed interest of a student of history, which I am. But does knowing how debt changed and morphed in American history, does that help us deal with it today, do you think?
I think it does. I think that from a historical perspective, understanding that debt is amoral, that it's not good or bad, but depends on the situation, is very important. So much of the discussion of the financial crisis has been in these moral terms of greed and people are what people are. Bankers have always been greedy. The question is, why do we let them have all our money to play with? Certainly in the last year, with the rise of Occupy Wall Street, you have an increased sense of, oh, people are concerned again about inequality. And for me, the essential question is, how did inequality produce indebtedness? And in the book, I talk about how the people at the top were not willing to pay people at the bottom wages, but they were willing to lend them money.
Lewis Hyman is an assistant professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. His new book is called Borrow, The American Way of Debt. Lewis, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Think about all the Google searches you've done today. Multiply that number by 365 days in a year. Multiply that by pretty much everybody around you. And what you have is piles and piles of data. Data that's valuable not only for advertisers, but for economists as well, who are mining it for all kinds of things they can learn about us. That's a convenient way to introduce Sendhil Mullainathan. He's a behavioral economist at Harvard University. Sendhil, good to talk to you.
Nice talking to you too, Kai.
So what's up?
I've got a question for you, Kai.
Of course, you just met me, but that's all right.
That's how I start all my conversations. Imagine you're stuck in a bunker deep under the ground.
All right.
All you have access to is a little sliver of the internet. The only thing you can really do is see what other people are doing on it. So what I want you to think about is, could you possibly learn anything?
So here's what I could learn. I could learn about the American election, probably, and yeah. I could learn about Kardashian and Paris Hilton and all that stuff.
That would be a good topic to learn something about. It turns out you can learn a bit more than that. If you just followed how many people were searching for the words monster.com,
yeah.
If you saw a big spike up, it's time to celebrate, albeit by yourself in a miserable bunker, but it's the new year. And you can also get pictures into what people sort of are thinking about others. Just go onto Google and type, why are Indians?
Okay. I didn't know there was going to be an actual thing here. All right, hang on. Why, what is it? Why are Indians?
Yeah, why are Indians? And then look for the autocomplete.
Oh, that's horrible. So it autocompletes this way, and I'm talking obviously to an Indian guy. Why are Indians so rude? Why are Indians so smart?
And
why
that's why it was pretty
so
good.
Yeah, that's right. So rude, so smart, so cheap. And then the fourth one is, why are Indians vegetarian?
Exactly. If you start to look a little bit at phrases like foreclosures or pawn shops, it becomes a leading economic indicator. So when these things start to go up, well, it looks like the economy is starting to tank. You know, we really want to know which way the economy is going, and we want to know it before it goes there.
Yeah.
So can we look and see whether people are searching for things like car purchases? Because those are pretty good leading indicators right. That people are starting to feel that times are good.
Yeah, and have them be truly leading indicators.
And exactly. Once the sales right. data comes in from Honda,
it's
well, that's,
late.
You know, too late.
Yeah.
And so if we want to know how Nashville is doing, that's kind of hard from a data point of view. But there are a lot of people in Nashville searching for a lot of things. So from an internet data point of view, it's not that hard. Here's an interesting way to collect data that's pretty useful, but you're getting it in a totally new way.
Is there a way, I mean, since we're on Google, right, and it controls the world, is there a way that you can do this without using the search function, right? I mean, it's not just search terms, can't be.
No, it's not just search terms. You know, when you search, you also get these ads. How is it that this guy ended up at the top of the list? Well, he paid.
Right.
And you can ask, how much does it cost? So if you look at a word like savings, to end up at the top of that list is like a dollar.
So that is the companies who want to be at the top of that list have to pay Google a dollar every time somebody clicks on it.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, for the words payday loans, it costs about $10. Hmm. So you're already getting a sense of where the money is.
Yeah.
Helping you save, somewhat profitable. Helping you get a payday loan, yeah, very profitable. But the highest one I've ever found, $50.
$50 per click?
Per click.
Oh, my gosh.
If someone is searching for the term structured settlements.
Okay, you have to explain what that is.
So now you get to learn something.
And I'm not even paying you $50 a click.
So when you go and get, like, some, let's say you get a lawsuit and the company pays you $500,000, but over 20 years.
Yeah.
And what people often do is they want to go and say, hey, I don't want to wait 20 years. Give me all my money right now. So there are companies out there will say, fine, we'll take your $500,000 spread out over 20 years and give you all your cash right now at some ridiculous discount. That's a structured settlement.
All right.
So there's a lot of money to be made.
Right. So $50 a click is nothing.
Nothing. Though, ironically, you could go right now, do it, click away, and you'd be charging these companies $50 a week.
That's what I had to do, right?
Yeah, if you're ever bored, man, this is a way to get...
You want to mess around with AdWords, pal? Here you go. Sendhil, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Sendhil Mullanathan. He teaches behavioral economics at Harvard.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which may well be the first time Entertainment Weekly has made an appearance on the broadcast, the 500th episode of The Simpsons is coming up next month, in fact. And EW reports they're going to have a special guest star for that episode. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange will make an appearance. Not so easy to get him, though. Apparently, The Simpsons executive producer was just given a number to call. Had to record him from house arrest over in the UK. All right, that's all we got. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media Today. The Dow lost 6 points, less than a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ gave up 4 points, about 0.2%. The S&P 500 slid 3 points, a 0.25%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, big payoffs mean bigger stakes.
You are taking the risk that you are going to find the gold. You are taking the risk that you are going to roll seven.
Playing the odds in the real economy. It's Marketplace's special election coverage. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.